It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're taking a look at the hodgepodge of U.S. voting systems and what it means for democracy. People in Oregon are really proud of the fact that they can mail in their ballots. They think the rest of us are kind of silly lining up. Many states have early voting, but the number of days varies. We're exploring various voting options, and we'd like to know how you think voting should work. 1-800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're exploring these voting systems with Barry Burton. He is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the director of the Elections Research Center and the Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics. Barry, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So why is the way we vote so different state by state?
Well, the short answer, I think, is the Constitution. The U.S. Constitution just doesn't give the federal government a lot of authority to regulate elections, and states have gotten quite used to doing things their own way. Aside from a few places where the federal government has decided it needs to be involved, for example, setting a common election day in November, protecting voting rights for minorities, and a few other interventions, really states have had the authority to do what they want now for over 200 years.
And this was on purpose. The people who started our country specifically did not want a big federal government telling people where to vote and how to vote.
Yeah, and I think keeping in mind the history that predates this is helpful to understand why that feeling was so strong. Before the Constitution was ratified, there was actually a first U.S. Constitution called the Articles of Confederation. And that Constitution, which we've lived under for a decade, gave states a lot of room to do all kinds of things. It really was a minimal central government and very strong state governments. And that reflected a concern that the colonists had about King George III and about the strong central government in the U.S. The Constitution itself was only ratified because there was an agreement to add the Bill of Rights, which would provide a lot of protections for people from their government. And so the idea of giving a government in Washington or New York or Philadelphia the power to regulate and create uniformity in elections around the country, I think was not even a possibility. As I say, the fact that there wasn't a common election day was practiced for many years. And
right.
So we've only slowly moved towards small steps towards uniformity.
So talk to us about the good parts of having states have different voting procedures and the bad parts, the drawbacks.
Well, the good parts is there's a lot of experimentation. Mm. And this is true in many policy areas, but also in elections. States get to try things, and some of those things work and end up taking hold and are mimicked by other states. For example, absentee voting was initially something that a few states did, essentially to elect people who were serving in the military vote from the front while they were away from home. That became a popular option, was adopted in more states, became more lenient and accommodating, and eventually grew into voting by mail and early voting and all the things we know today. I think the experimentation also lets states try different things that work well for their contexts. For example, in Montana, there's a lot of voting by mail. And that's really helpful because people live a long way from the county seat where the polling place might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than drive those long distances, they can simply get the ballot by mail and send it back at their convenience. So I think there are real benefits, but there are also drawbacks in that voters living in different states, sometimes adjacent states, have really different voting experiences and different things that are available to them depending on which side of the border they happen to be living.
Yeah, and there's small things, too, you know, like whether people who live miles away from a polling booth can mail in their ballots or do it perhaps electronically. There are different windows for voter registration, what kind of identification you need at the polls. Why do those things matter so much?
Well, they matter a lot, and I think you can get a sense that they matter because partisan elected officials are fighting about them.
Right.
The fact that early voting and voter ID laws are controversial in state legislatures is a sign that politicians feel pretty sure they know that those things matter and even which party would be benefited by them.
So let's look at this. Early voting. What matters with early voting?
Well, there's a lot of variation in early voting. Some states have let it run wild so that there is essentially no election day anymore. It's an early voting period or a voting season. And whereas other states have hung on to a traditional election day and most voters are still going to old-fashioned polling places on a single day in November, it matters because it turns out there's a partisan difference in the use of early voting. Democratic voters tend to take to it more, especially early voting in person. Republican voters tend to be more traditional polling place voters or sometimes voting by mail. And that has led Democratic and Republican policymakers to think that they can tweak the law in a way that's going to help their parties. Turns out sometimes they're wrong about that. For example, introducing early voting probably doesn't have a big effect on the partisan mix of who participates and how. But once it's in place, taking it away would have a pretty big effect because people become accustomed to or habituate to the options that are available to them. And removing them really disrupts voting behavior and can have big effects.
So what are the drawbacks to just having one voting day?
Well, there must be a lot because states have been moving away from it in pretty dramatic fashion. Though it is what was done for a couple of hundred years. So somehow democracy survived with a single election day. You know, I think we have a society that's mobile and transient. Many people are not near their home and near the neighborhood polling place on a single day in November.
On a Tuesday in the middle of the week, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a Tuesday, and so there are people who are working or at school or caring for family members or traveling, and so giving them some options is really helpful. We have a lot of people who live away from home, away from a traditional home. They might be in a retirement facility, a nursing home, a dormitory on a college campus, a military base. And so you add up those categories, and it's actually a large share of the population that doesn't have a kind of traditional home, you know, in a neighborhood sort of thing. And then once it's been offered, voters become used to it, and parties and campaigns begin to take advantage of it and try to exploit the law that exists to help win more votes. And it's very difficult to unroll those things then. Once the option has been made available, it doesn't get taken away very often.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. Voter ID laws have been big, especially in Wisconsin. What do they do? What are they intended to do? And what do critics say they do?
Well, the one thing that a voter ID law can do is stop voter impersonation. That is, a voter pretending to be someone else.
And does that happen that often?
That is extremely rare. You have to remember that we have two steps to the process in the United States. One is registering to vote, where a person establishes their residence and gets on the rolls. And then a second step, which is voting. And voter ID only occurs at that second step. So by then, a voter has already established where they live and their eligibility, and they're on the rolls. And they are then stating to a poll worker or somehow showing who they are. There's always been a form of ID in American elections. It's just typically been a person stating their name when they arrive at the polls, maybe a name and address, maybe signing a poll book. But in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a real movement to adopt harder forms of identification, stricter forms. In places like Wisconsin, that means a few forms of government ID with a photo and a signature. And as I say, that's intended to stop voter impersonation, but of all the kinds of shenanigans that happen in elections or crimes that might be committed, voter impersonation is probably the rarest. It's just one that doesn't happen very often. So the law doesn't seem especially well tailored to the kinds of concerns we might have about election security.
So what do critics say about this?
Critics, mostly Democrats, would say it's an attempt by Republicans to suppress the votes of people who don't have identification or have a more difficult time getting it. That would be students, young people, minority voters, people living in urban areas. Those are the groups that are less likely to have ID in the first place and have more challenges getting it. The fact that it's not, that the law is not matched up with where most of the security concerns are in elections, that it's targeting this really unusual, rare form of voter fraud, suggests that it may have other motivations. And so that's the complaint, and that partisan division is not going away. There's just more polarization in views about voter ID than probably any other election practice.
Right. So what are the things that happen in terms of voter fraud?
Well, we know that elections are not perfect. It's just a very complicated thing to pull off. Imagine trying to host a one-day national event. Think of it like a festival or a concert or a marathon that a bunch of officials are putting on in a bunch of places with tens of thousands of volunteers. In Wisconsin, on a presidential election day, there's something like 30,000 poll workers who have volunteered to work the day. And they're working in places that are not intended to be government offices. They're churches and schools and, you know, community centers where polling places are being held. It's really challenging. And so mistakes are made. And there are some people who will try to take advantage of the system. I think where people would point to security concerns are mostly around absentee ballots. Those are ballots that go out in the mail and are then out of the custody of the states. And there are, you know, occasional anecdotes about those ballots being intercepted in the mail, being taken from mailboxes, or one person completing the ballot on someone else's behalf and submitting it for them. So, you know, that's the place where I think there's probably some room for improvement in building up security, less so for voter impersonation at the polls.
And we're not talking about that. We're not talking about absentee ballots and making security better for that.
Some states are doing things in that area. And in fact, the states that do lots of voting by mail, places like Colorado and Oregon and Washington, have really sophisticated systems for tracking ballots in the mail electronically with barcodes.
Wow.
Voters can check in on their own ballot at any time to see where it is, just the way they would track any other package that they've ordered. But it's fewer states that do that, and many just have a kind of looser set of regulations that govern absentee ballots.
We are talking about voting laws and the fact that they're different in every state in the country. Barry Burden is joining us, and we will be back in a moment to take your calls. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. California and Maine captivated voting systems nerds this primary season. They tried different ways of counting votes. California had a top two primary in which the two top vote getters, regardless of party, would go against each other in the general election. And Maine had their first vote under ranked choice voting. Interestingly, also, Mainers were asked for the second time to approve ranked choice voting, which the sitting politicians do not like. So what do you think of our voting here in Wisconsin? Do you think it makes sense that states have their own voting systems, or should we have a more uniform national system? 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Answering your questions this morning is UW Elections expert Barry Burden. So, Barry, I want to keep, before we get to California and Maine, because that just totally fascinates me, I want to keep talking a little bit about the barriers to voting. There are studies out there that say in some elections, all it takes to discourage people to vote is bad weather.
It's true. Yeah, that lore turns out to be right, backed up by evidence. The more precipitation, the less likely that voters show up. And I think that signals what a sensitive decision this is. Voting takes a little bit of effort. There's some cost involved. You know, a voter needs to figure out where to go and how to register and what times the polling places are open and which candidates are on the ballot. So there's some work on that side to be done. And then the payoff from voting is relatively low. It's not likely that most of us will ever decide an election with our single vote, that it will be a tied election aside from our ballot. There are some social benefits from voting. You get to, if you're at a polling place, see some neighbors and friends maybe and feel good about participating in democracy. But the fact that the benefits are sort of amorphous and hard to define and that there are some costs involved in participating means that little things can matter a lot. Certainly being sick, having an illness deters people, having difficulty with mobility, getting out of the house, having other obligations, but even a little rain or snow Some of these costs we've talked about, like an ID requirement or a onerous registration process or a polling place that got moved from a familiar location to an unfamiliar location, all of those can have pretty dramatic effects on turnout.
We are talking about voting systems, and we're taking your calls. Anne from Green Bay, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning. I'm just wondering, what about a smartphone app to vote?
Ah.
But that's not what I called, though. I called because I think online voting would make so much more sense, and actually an app on your phone would make sense. But with the hacking of this day and age, I guess that's my concern is, how do you know your vote's going to go where it's supposed to go and be counted? And then how do you deal with people in the rural areas who don't have the broadband?
Ah, yes. Thank you, Anne. That's a really great question. You know, there are a number of states, Barry, I've heard that are advocating for no electronic voting, going all the way back to paper voting. So where are we on this?
Well, you know, after the 2000 election, if you remember that meltdown in Florida and some of the reforms that came about afterwards, most of the states went out and bought new voting equipment. And they very quickly went for touch screens and other high-tech technologies. Since then, they've backed away. And there's been a real movement, especially since the 2016 election, to have, if not paper ballots, at least a paper backup, paper trail, as it's called, for any touch screen machine. It's an old technology, but it's tried and true, and if there's any concern about elections, about what's happened on election day or the integrity of the machines, a paper ballot gives you a kind of confidence that you can get the vote right. You can count those ballots by hand. You can see them. They're tangible. They're auditable after an election. So I think that is now a best practice that everyone has realized. There needs to be a paper version of the vote. And just about every state is there. There are a few who are laggards, but I think they're going to be there pretty quickly.
You know, one thing that I've always wondered is we always talk about voter turnout, and it is always about 50%. It kind of hovers around that 50. Sometimes it's 52 or 53%. Sometimes it's lower. These are in general elections. It's a lot lower in midterm elections and in primaries. Why don't most people vote, Barry?
Well, it's a good question. I think there's not one answer to that. There are probably lots of answers. Presidential elections are the one time when most Americans would say they feel a sense of duty. That's a job of a citizen to participate at least once every 4 years. And it's relatively easy to participate in those elections because the information that a voter might want gets provided, maybe more than they would like. There's lots of campaign activity, advertising, debates, media coverage. It's hard not to be aware of what's going on in a presidential election. But as soon as you move away from that environment to a midterm election, or especially to a primary or local special election, the free information that people might get about what's happening is just much less. There's very little advertising, less media coverage. Think even about the August primary that's coming up in Wisconsin. It's a pretty important election. We're going to choose nominees for governor and U.S. senator and a bunch of other state and federal offices. And yet lots of voters show in the Marquette Law Poll that they're unfamiliar with the candidates, that they haven't learned much about them yet. And that process is going to have to accelerate if people are going to participate in mid-August, which is just over a month away. And I think that's typical. Those non-presidential elections just have less of a stimulus attached to them. And it means that only the hardcore voters or the most dedicated participants are the ones who show up.
So what's interesting to me here is that there are academics out there who have talked about how there could be different ways of getting to voters and getting voters to show up. Can you talk to me about some of those ways that we can do that?
Well, we do know from research that there are some practices that work really well. One is Election Day registration. This is a practice that exists in Wisconsin and has since the 1970s, and has really grown in its popularity across the states. Just in the last few years, a number of states have added Election Day registration. And research shows that that increases turnout because it essentially reduces the two voting steps to one. Rather than having to register in one place and time and then cast a ballot at another place and time, Election Day registration is one-stop shopping. In Wisconsin or Minnesota or Iowa, a voter can go to the polls, register right on the spot or update their registration right on the spot, and then cast a ballot. And so linking those two things together really reduced the cost of participating and has a pretty significant effect on voter turnout and even on reducing the inequality in turnout. The kinds of people who benefit most from EDR, election day registration, tend to be those who are not as participatory. So it has a number of benefits. There are disputes, I would say, about just about every other kind of reform you can imagine. Right. Early voting, there are studies showing that it increases turnout and reduces inequality and participation, but there are studies that show just the opposite, that it's really a convenience for people who are already likely to vote. Voting by mail or voting at home, as it's called in a number of states out west, same thing. Research is really mixed about whether that's beneficial. So, you know, there's not a silver bullet. It's a complicated system, and voters are complicated and respond to different kinds of incentives.
We are talking to Barry Burden about elections and why elections are different in so many different states. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Barry, I've got a kind of a unique situation here. I just moved here. I need a voter ID to register, even if I register same day, correct?
That's right, yes.
So if I don't move into, I'm in temporary housing, if I don't move into my permanent house until the day after Election Day, I can't vote in the primary, right?
You can vote as long as you have a residence somewhere. It doesn't need to be a permanent residence for the rest of your life, but to have been a resident, I think it's for 10 days before the election.
But then I have to go, but then I have to get a voter ID. Like I have to change my license right away and then change my license, my address again in order to do that, correct?
Yeah, that's right. There are two separate steps. And so one is establishing residency and getting registered at a place. So that establishes where you live. They know what ward you're in and which offices you should vote on. And then a second step is showing your identity. And in Wisconsin, an out-of-state driver's license is not acceptable. So you'll need an in-state license or a veteran's ID or a passport or a tribal ID,
right,
or a student ID with some other kinds of things attached to it. So, you know, there are five or six different kinds of ID that will be acceptable.
So right away there, that's a burden. Like I have to go get a license from where I'm living now, which I intend to do, actually. And then I have to then go, when I move in a month and a half, get another license for that place just so that I could vote.
That's right. You've got some work cut out for you to get ready for the election. It's not a pain-free process. There's some administrative hassle associated with voting. And, you know, there is election day registration in Wisconsin, so you might be able to execute two steps at once. But still, there's some work that's going to have to be done in advance. And for some people, that can include additional homework, like finding a birth certificate or tracking down other documents they need in order to get the license or the state ID card or whatever it would be to be eligible to vote.
Right, and mine is in transit right now. So also Roland from Lancaster emailed. He said that Wisconsin suffers from voter suppression, especially in Milwaukee. Does the voting system have an effect on which voters show up and who feels disenfranchised? He says he feels pretty disenfranchised.
The voting system certainly has an effect on who feels enfranchised and who participates. There are surveys of voters asking them whether they are confident in the voting system, how difficult they find the system, and that varies in some systematic ways and some surprising, interesting ways. So voters who have fewer resources, who have lower levels of education or lower incomes or move more frequently, will describe the process as being more onerous, and it's just more difficult for them. So that's a fact. But also, people who support the party who lost the last election, who are on the losing side, tend to view the process as less fair, and are they're less confident about their vote being counted properly than those who are on the winning side.
Interesting.
And that flips back and forth depending on what happened in the most recent election. So that tends to be a consequence of current events rather than long-term structure.
That is an interesting point. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Joe from Waukesha, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I am not sure how many, but I'm sure there's more than just Australia. But Australia requires all of its citizens to perform their duty, as they would see it, to vote. And if they choose not to vote, then they pay a fine. And I think it's certainly one of the, you know, obviously they have among, not surprisingly, one of the highest rates of voting in the world because of this fact. And I think that's, there seems to be at least, I think, in a sense, encouraging people to see how important the act of voting is. And because I think, particularly in this country, we face the serious danger of, attempting to prevent people from voting with IDs and other means. And so, as I said again, anything that would help, I suppose, encourage voting, and particularly if it hits people's pocketbook.
Thank you, Joe, for that. Barry, I want to get to, before we run out of time, we got some time left, but I want to get to the other systems of voting. There are, when we're talking about presidential voting, there are caucus states and there are primary states. I cannot imagine that Iowa would ever give up its caucuses. But what are the burdens and what are the benefits of having caucuses rather than primaries?
It's true there's a mix of caucuses and primaries, especially at the presidential level. Majority of states have now gone to primaries since a wave of reforms in the late 60s and early 70s, but there are some caucus holdouts, including Iowa. There are really fundamental differences between the two. The caucus is run by a party, not by the state. So it's essentially a private event, and they create the rules. In Iowa, ironically, there can be one set of rules in the Democratic caucuses, another set in the Republican caucuses, and yet a different set of rules for voters in the general election.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's now going to be a voter ID requirement in Iowa starting next year if you vote in a regular election, but there might not be an ID requirement if you participate in a caucus. Caucuses are intensive events. A person needs to show up at a neighborhood facility like a gymnasium or a church and hang out for a couple of hours. It's a meeting, and there are a series of processes that have to take place, and all the local caucus does is select nominees to go on to the next round of caucuses, maybe at the county level, and then those caucuses a few weeks later with delegates on to the congressional district and then to a state convention in the summer.
And those votes can change.
It's a one-day event.
Right, and those votes can change. That's what we learned in Nevada in 2016. You go in and you vote as a group, so it's majority wins, and then that could be at your county or that could be at your municipality level, regional, and then it goes to the county, and it's really whoever shows up at the county level who can then change the vote. And then it may change again at the state level, which became a huge problem for Democrats in Nevada in 2016. So why have caucuses?
Why have caucuses? One reason is that it gives the party more control over the process. Primaries are a little scary for a political party. They're essentially handing over control of picking a nominee to the public. And in Wisconsin and other states where there are open primaries, anyone can participate in either party primary. Just show up and decide which ballot you want and start casting. So, you know, it really removes the party's hands from that process. A caucus at least gives the party some control over who can be in the room. It tends to be registered partisans, sometimes people who have registered in advance. You can control the rules of that process, which candidates are considered. The participation tends to be much lower. A primary might get 20 or 30 or 40% of people participating. A caucus might get 5 or 10% of people participating. And so it's more controlled in that way. It tends to be party regulars rather than average voters off the street. So there's a trade-off for sure.
But isn't that voter suppression? And doesn't that take away our one person, one vote thing?
Boy, there are mixed views on this. And I'm not going to take a hard side, lay out the competing arguments. The advocates of the caucus would say that it's better democracy, that this is people meeting face-to-face and making arguments to one another about who the better candidate is, talking with their neighbors. It's deliberative. It's a complicated process, and so it's not going to make a rash decision. Whereas the primary is this one-day flash event where a mob shows up, chooses a nominee, and goes home, and the party's stuck with them. You know, I think the other argument is easier to see, that the caucus is really a kind of controlled process that keeps people out. It's demanding, and there are people who simply don't have the time to sit in a gymnasium for 2 hours in February and talk through the candidates. It tends to reward the extremists. Caucuses tend to nominate more extreme, hardcore partisan candidates than do primaries. So there's that trade-off as well.
We are talking with Barry Burden of UW-Madison about voting systems, why they're different in so many states. We're going to come back and talk about new forms of voting that states have dreamt up in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're examining different voting systems and what effect they have on democracy with UW election expert Barry Burden. What do you think of Wisconsin's voting system? Do you like the same-day registration idea? What about voter ID? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Barry, I'm really excited about this ranked choice voting thing, just because I want to see how it plays out and how it makes a difference. What have we learned from Maine? First of all, let's explain what ranked choice voting is.
Yeah, so ranked choice voting, it's used in a number of countries and actually in a lot of cities for mayoral and city council elections, places like Minneapolis and San Francisco. The idea is that a voter arrives at the polling place, and instead of choosing one candidate over all the others, they're allowed to rank the candidates in order from number one, who they prefer most, to whoever's last. It can be a large number of candidates. Those votes then get submitted, and if any candidate gets a majority of ones, so there's a majority of voters who pick that candidate first, they're elected, just like a traditional U.S. election. But if no candidate has a majority of number one rankings, then the lowest-ranked candidate gets dropped from the pool, and their number one votes get redistributed to the other candidates, to the candidates who would be ranked number two. Mm. Then the tabulation happens again. If a candidate has a majority, they're chosen. If not, the next lowest-ranked candidate is removed, and the votes are redistributed again.
So the number three votes for that lowest-ranked candidate, are the number three votes for that lowest-ranked candidate, or the number two votes go to the other candidates? Or no?
When the first lowest-ranked candidate is removed, all of the voters who chose that person first would have their votes transferred to their second-place choice.
Ah, and the next person... Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say there are a couple rationales for doing this. One that I think is easier to see right away is that it's supposed to help minor party, third party, and fringe candidates who voters might normally think they'd be throwing their vote away on or might be spoiling the election. If you remember Ralph Nader's presence in the 2000 election, there were accusations that Democrats or progressives who voted for him may have cost Al Gore the election. Well, under ranked choice voting, a voter could vote for a Nader kind of candidate and not fear that they're spoiling the election, because if they make him first and he turns out not to be the winner and so he's discarded as the lowest ranked candidate, his votes would be redistributed. And if those voters had marked Al Gore, say, as their second choice, Gore would get all those votes and, you know, may have won the election in Florida, say. So there's that appeal that it might prevent people from shying away from less traditional candidates for fear that they're not viable. There's also the idea that candidates might play nice with one another rather than insult one another on a campaign trail, because they're going to need the second place and third place support of their opponent's voters. And we actually saw this in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago in their mayoral primary. There were a couple of candidates running against one another for mayor, and they actually cross-endorsed each other. They said, if you're voting for this person, please rank me as your second, and vice versa. And so there may be more interesting coalitions built in these multi-candidate races if you have ranked choice voting.
So the officials in Maine have fought this tooth and nail. As I mentioned earlier, they have made voters go to the polls twice in a referendum, this time and about 2 years ago, to say, yes, we still want ranked choice voting. So as they were ranking just a few weeks ago, they were also saying, yes, we want to keep ranked choice voting. So why are officials so dead set against this?
Well, in general, we would say that politicians don't like to mess with the system that got them elected. So whether it's ranked choice voting or it's the top two primary in California or it's redistricting reform, a lot of these innovations are done over the objections of office holders who don't like to see changes to the system. Most of these things are adopted by ballot initiatives, by referendums, mm-hmm. where voters actually impose them, as in Maine. In fact, the governor in Maine said he might not certify the results from the election there, which was the first to use ranked choice voting.
Because now, there's something in the Constitution that says that there's something in the Constitution that he is pointing to, right?
Yeah, he's on shaky ground. First of all, it was a primary, so it's not clear he has to certify anything because these weren't elections, they were nominations. But he's this kind of outlandish figure, and it's actually him. This is Governor LePage in Maine, who is the target of ranked choice voting. I think there's some concern about him as a character. He was elected with less than a majority of the vote. He's been kind of a controversial governor, and so I think that helped fuel, actually, the proponents of ranked choice voting to put in a process they thought might lead to a more consensual kind of candidate.
Have you seen the results? Have you seen any preliminary studies? How well did it do? And is this something that other states are looking to adopt?
Other states are definitely looking to adopt it. Maine is fortunate that ranked choice voting had been used in the city of Portland for a while, and so voters there had some experience. It wasn't completely foreign. And that's the way these reforms often creep in. There's a little bit of a testing or experience with them, and then it gets adopted on a wider scale. I don't think we know just yet whether ranked choice voting is going to solve all the problems it's intended to deal with, whether animosity on the campaign trail and the threat of a candidate spoiling the vote, if those things are going to go away. Where it's been used, it's been mostly in city elections, which are nonpartisan, so we don't know what that does to the party mix of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like they carried off the election in Maine just fine. Voters were not especially confused by the system. They managed to tabulate the results, you know, not as quickly as voters are used to, but relatively quickly. So we'll have to see. I think the general election will be the first real test where we learn something significant.
We are talking to Barry Burden of the Election Resource Center about voting and why systems are different in different states. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We've got a number of callers here. Marty from Lake Geneva, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Let's refresh a bit. The percentage of voter fraud in Wisconsin prior to the implementation of the voter ID law was 0.0034. That means that it was about 219 potential cases of voter fraud, of which maybe a bit more than 100 were people going to the wrong poll. Do you in your wildest dreams think the Republican Party is going to align themselves with mandatory voting? I just can't see this party turning masochistic.
Do you want to take that, Barry?
Well, yeah, this is back to Joe's earlier question about mandatory or what's sometimes called compulsory voting. It is used in a lot of countries. Australia is the most prominent one where voters are required to cast ballots. But it's actually dozens of countries that require this. And in many of them, if a voter does not cast a ballot, they pay a fine. And so turnout rates in those countries tend to be 85, 90, 95%, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Marty's right that really it doesn't fit probably with the Republican Party's philosophy, but even with the American ethos in general. We're not big as a culture on requiring people to do things. We offer incentives and, you know, try to create structures that nudge people to do things, but mandates are less common in the U.S. than in other places. So that seems like a stretch to imagine that would ever be adopted here.
Roger from Madison wants to talk about ranked choice voting, which we were just talking about. Roger, welcome to the program.
Hi. Different form of ranked choice voting that was used has a long history in Illinois. It was used for 110 years.
Hmm. Where?
To elect their representatives. And the way that it worked was that the representative districts each elected three representatives. As a voter, you got to distribute your votes among those three representatives.
Mm.
And you could do it in three different ways. You could give all your votes to one representative who you particularly liked, and they would get credit for three votes. You could distribute them evenly among the three, in which they'd each get one vote, or you could vote for two, in which they'd each get a vote and a half.
So you would have, so when you walked in, you would have 10 votes to distribute among three people.
No, you have three votes to distribute.
Oh, okay. So
those are just the three different ways you can do it.
Got it.
So, and this was actually a very good system, because very much unlike what's going on here in Wisconsin now, almost everybody in Illinois had would end up having at least one person sitting in the assembly that they felt was kind of a decent representative for them.
I'm going to throw that to Barry, Roger. This reminds me of something that actually talk to me about what was happening in Illinois, and then we'll go on from there.
Yeah, I'm glad Roger brought this up. It is a system that's been used in some places, especially in some city councils. It's sometimes called cumulative voting because voters have these votes that they can allocate in a cumulative way. They can pile them up all on one candidate if they really like that person, or distribute them across several candidates. That's mostly gone by the wayside, but one thing that has hung around from that Illinois system are districts that elect more than one legislator. There are still about, I think, half a dozen states where state legislators are chosen in multi-member districts, that is, two or three or four seats in a single district. And so in places like West Virginia, Arizona, New Hampshire, voters there can have two or three representatives who stand for them. I think, to Roger's point, might not feel that all of the legislators from their districts represent their views, but at least one of them, you would think, would be likely to match up with their ideas.
I don't understand. So districts come together, and I can help elect somebody from where I live and somebody in a neighboring district. I'm not really sure understand how that works.
It's the system is one district, but multiple seats within that district. The U.S. Senate is of this form, right? Each state is one district, but it has two senators or two seats.
Ah.
They happen to be staggered, so they're not up at the same time. But in most of these states where there are multi-member districts, the seats are actually up at the same time.
Hmm.
So in New Hampshire, every constituent has two representatives who represent the same district, the same people, essentially. And that's true in a number of other states. So even without this cumulative voting system that Roger talked about, having several members in a district, I think it's still possible, and states are still doing it.
Very interesting. Matt from Sussex, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with a gentleman by the name of Chris Kobach, who does this cross-check system, and then also a gentleman by the name of Greg Pallas, who is an investigative reporter who actually has a documentary out called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And what he does is in regards to, I guess, what I would refer to as election manipulating. And I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with that and if he could speak to that issue.
Thank you. Matt, Barry?
I don't know the documentary, but I do know of Chris Kobach.
Yes.
He was Secretary of State of Kansas, is now running for governor of Kansas. He was the head of President Trump's short-lived commission on election integrity. Really controversial figure, really aggressive in trying to hunt down vote fraud, and helped create this system that Matt refers to called the cross-check system, where states were comparing their voter files against one another and trying to find instances of double registration, double voting. That system turned out to have a lot of errors that mistakenly identified people with similar names and didn't have the security protections that it should have had, and so a number of states like Illinois that were initially part of the cross-check system have now backed out of it.
Mm.
There is an alternative system, which is much more sophisticated, and I think bipartisan, called ERIC. That's the Electronic Registration Information Center. Wisconsin is now part of that system, as are a couple dozen other states. And it's a really just a sophisticated operation that lets states compare data and try to identify voters who have moved, voters who have died, and clean up the rolls and actually encourage more people to become registered. So the co-op system is, I would say, is tainted by a kind of style of his and disputes about how well it works, but there are alternatives that people might latch on to.
Thank you very much, Matt. Randy from Madison, last caller. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, good morning. This is much more interesting than it has any reason to be. I was a fan, still am, I think, of none of the above options on ballots. So I'm wondering, and I believe Arizona used to have that. I don't know if they still do. I wonder if you do. And also, I believe there's a handful of states that have proportionate allocation of electoral college voting. Is that something that has any chance of catching on?
Thank you, Randy, for that. I'm pretty sure Nebraska has proportionate allocation. So take that one first, and then let's take none of the above.
Yeah, so the Electoral College, just about all the states have decided to use majority rule, and they give all of their electoral votes to whichever candidate wins the most popular votes in the state. Nebraska and Maine are the holdouts, and they allocate based on congressional districts, so it's sort of proportional. It's possible other states could do that. Every state has the right to do it as they wish. There is an interesting plan out there to circumvent the Electoral College altogether. It's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, where states would essentially agree to give all of their electoral votes to whoever won the national popular vote. So that would get around problems like the one in 2016, where one candidate won the popular vote, one won the Electoral College vote. Those would always be the same person under this deal.
So hang on a second. So that also happened in 2000. And from what I understand, because I had forgotten about this national popular vote, from what I understand, not all states have to sign up for this, just enough states to have a majority of electoral college votes, correct?
That's right. You just need 270 electoral votes to be elected president. And so once enough states have signed on to get to that threshold, it goes into effect. I think right now it's the number of states who have signed on gets them somewhere around 170 or 180 electoral votes. So they're going to need some more big states to sign on to make this go into effect.
I think we will follow up on that. Barry Burden, we could go talking for hours on this. Barry is a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center and the Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks for being with us, Barry.
Yeah, glad being with you. Thanks.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, and Laura Pavin. Dave Potraz is our technical director today. Keely Bultina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.